It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, being a teenager is never easy, and being the parent of a teen can be a challenge. In just a bit, a pediatrician tells us how to support teenagers during hard times in a changing world. First, our next guest helped create a global survey on well-being and burnout during COVID-19. 89% of respondents said their work life was getting worse. 85% said their well-being had declined. About half said their job demands had increased during the pandemic. Our guest says the pandemic has shined a light on the already existing problem of burnout in our work lives and made it worse. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been feeling burnout with your work lately, longer than just lately? Has your work life gotten harder or easier in the last year? Do you feel like your workload is unsustainable? If you run a workplace as a manager, a business owner, or what have you found ways to help your team deal with burnout? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Jennifer Moss is a speaker and expert on burnout and well-being at work. She's the author of the forthcoming book, The Burnout Epidemic, out in September, and she wrote the piece Beyond Burned Out for the Harvard Business Review. Jennifer, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Jennifer, I think when we say burnout at the workplace, people kind of have a sense, maybe even a vivid feeling of what that's like. What do we mean when we say burnout?
Well, burnout has just been recently defined by the World Health Organization in 2019, actually, as an occupational phenomena. It's basically unmanaged stress, chronic stress at work that has been left over time to essentially fester into burnout. So what is so important about the WHO definition is that it actually did try to distinguish it as, you know, this workplace phenomena. But essentially, it's just over time, just having these unsustainable workloads, feeling a lack of control at work, feeling like there's insufficient rewards for effort. There's just a lack of close friends at work or a supportive community. Lack of fairness and mismatched values and skills. Those are the six root causes of burnout at work.
And Jennifer, you were raising the alarm about burnout before the pandemic. How much worse have things gotten? I shared a few of your statistics from your survey there. How much worse is burnout now in this COVID-19 world?
You know, essentially, it's like we lit a match to a workforce in drought. And, you know, crises tend to exacerbate existing problems, and burnout has been a big problem because it really is systemic issues that are causing people to be burnout. So this has been a long, you know, journey in the process to 2020 and 2021. But in the epidemic, we just basically catapulted the future of work from, you know, the future to the present. And so all of those broken systems were stress tested and all of them failed.
And you used a key word there in your writing, systemic. There's been a lot of talk about how to deal with burnout as individuals, and self-care and maybe therapy, whatever. And that's all important stuff. But you think we need a more systematic solution. What kind of changes do you think need to be made?
You know, this has been a big part of the conversation that I've tried to shift and sort of rethink the way that leaders and organizations and employees feel about burnout. And that is, you know, it's really important to have self-care when we're looking at optimization. When we have a well-being strategy, we have tactics that manage for people's, you know, happiness and mental health and taking them sort of from good to great. So, you know, exercises and, you know, breathing and subsidized gym memberships and yoga and well tech, all of that is really great for optimization, but they are not a burnout prevention strategy. So there's, you know, well-being strategy and a burnout prevention strategy. A burnout prevention strategy is, you know, really looking at the big root causes that are way further tackled upstream. When we're talking about, you know, people overworking and they're at 60 hours a week, or they've been micromanaged, or they're being bullied at work, you know, you can't suggest that listening to rain for 30 seconds is going to be the solution to these major problems that need to be dealt with in a much bigger way. And so I think it's just tone deaf when leaders suggest these things. And we need to get better at not individualizing the problem of burnout, but making it about a holistic sort of all around company-wide problem where the employee and the employer come together to fix it.
Talking to Jennifer Moss, expert on burnout, author of the forthcoming book, The Burnout Epidemic. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions, thoughts, and experiences on being burned out at work. We heard from Scott in Menominee, who says, how much do other responsibilities of daily life, like parenting or extracurricular activities, contribute to burnout? A hot question, especially with a lot of at-home school going on, Jennifer.
Well, I think what's so interesting is that when we describe it, you know, burnout as an occupational phenomena, we're not identifying the space where that exists. And I think this year, for example, instead of working from home, we're living at work. Everything is just culminated into this space. And so external pressures play a big role. I mean, we've even seen just a year of chronic stress change the way our brains are responding to, you know, workload. We're being sort of taxed and working more hours to get to those pre-COVID goals and working 30% more hours per day. We've added an extra 48 minutes to our workday. We've increased meetings, the number of meetings by 24% just in this last year. So there's so many other things that are happening. And we're also just dealing with the impact mentally of chronic stress. So everything is tiring. We're less engaged. We have a harder time getting up and getting motivated in the morning. I mean, there's so many things that are impacting our well-being. And then we add this expectation of working at the same levels like business as usual pre-COVID. And it turns it into a really unsustainable problem.
How do you go to somebody who maybe owns or runs a business and says, I don't see the problem. Yeah, people are working a little more. The job is getting done. The revenue is still flowing. So why should I fix what ain't broke from that perspective? What would you say to that executive who isn't feeling that maybe just that sheer empathy for their employees?
Well, I love that you said the word empathy, because so much of what I write about in the book is if we actually just changed our organizations and our leaders to be human-centered, really, and driven by empathy, we would catch a lot of these problems further upstream. Because if we just sort of measure success with these engagement metrics, you know, productivity metrics, we're sort of shipping product and we're still, you know, showing up to work, we're missing the downstream impact of people actually getting very unwell. And when you know, actually take someone to the point of burnout, the rebound could be 18 months to 2 years of that employee being either lost completely, that talent's gone, or being on mental health or disability leave. There's a lot of implications from a revenue and financial standpoint from, you know, for businesses and leaders of organizations to be thinking about. But it's more about just like, what is the goal here? You want to retain your employees. You want to make sure that they're healthy and happy because they are more productive and they are better for the organization overall. And so that attitude is just a win-win overall for the success of any company.
We're talking to Jennifer Moss, a speaker and expert on burnout and well-being at work. She wrote a piece for the Harvard Business Review called Beyond Burned Out. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you wish your employer would have done differently in this last year? What kind of shakeups did you see at your workplace? Are you working more because of COVID? Did you feel burned out already pre-COVID, 2019? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or have you found solutions? 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Jennifer Moss, a speaker and expert on burnout and the workplace, and the author of a forthcoming book on that subject. You can find a piece she wrote for Harvard Business Review, Beyond Burned Out. And you can join in if you'd like at 800-642-1234. Are you now or have you ever experienced workplace burnout? What was it like? What caused that problem for you? Too much work? A sense that your thoughts and decisions didn't matter? Was there something that fixed it for you? On the other side, if you manage people, how have you tried to help deal with and prevent workplace burnout? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. And Jennifer, something I keep hearing when I talk to people at the workplace is the importance of people having a sense of power and autonomy at the workplace. And you write that's part of the puzzle here with burnout. What does that mean?
Yes, definitely. One of the root causes is perceived lack of control, which is essentially feeling like you have no agency or choice, that you're being micromanaged. And it's interesting because both the person that's being micromanaged and the micromanager are more prone to burnout, because you want to feel like, you know, you have some agency or some ability to make decisions about how you do your work or how you get to your goals. And so what's happened during the pandemic is that a lot of managers who used to feel like, you know, if I see you, that means you're working, they've had to go in this totally different direction where they're managing remote teams. And so I think employees and individuals have felt like maybe their manager has been really on top of them. I have one example of one company that basically, if you were off of Slack for 5 minutes, you had to tell people you were going to be away from the social collaboration chat. And, you know, people feeling like they have to put up their hand to go to the bathroom. I mean, it's just a really interesting environment right now. So we've seen that kind of need for control really increasing through the pandemic.
How does an organization break that micromanagement culture habit?
Well, you know, you really do have to have trust, because trust is one of the most important sort of antidotes or prophylaxes to burnout. The more that you have trust within coworkers, so you all trust each other, or you trust your boss trusts you, what happens is that you just have more cohesion, you have more psychological safety, people feel like they can talk openly about their ideas, they feel more supported. So all of this stuff just increases, success in an organization. I had the chance to talk with the chief people officer of Hewlett Packard, who'd been working through, you know, COVID. He had 60,000 employees. And so what he did was just made everything sort of open for discussion, and social collaboration sort of chats became part of their everyday. And people that wanted to talk about parenting and needed tips, they connected online. And then people that were singles, that were living in small, you know, apartments and trying to work in this environment, connected. And so just opening people up to talk about what they need to, and creating relationships and healthy, trusting relationships, that is really critical to beating burnout inside of organizations.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Jim is with us in Beaver Dam. Jim, hello.
Hello. Thanks for taking the call.
What do you want to tell us about, Jim?
Well, I used to work union construction, and so I've worked jobs that we pull 7/13s, which that's 7 days a week, 13 hours a day. And wow. At first, the burnout hit immediately, and it was hard to carry through. They were short-lived jobs, of course. But about the second job, I started realizing that I'd stopped looking at the work the way – okay, so I look at things like my what I produce is a reflection on me, you know. And as soon as I started getting back into looking at, you know, how I was doing things and making sure that I was happy with what I was doing, and got away from looking at what other people were doing around me, you know. And then there's also, I like staying busy because it makes a day go by fast. And once I started getting back into thinking about things like that, I lost the burnout. It really didn't affect me at all.
Jim, just before I let you go, was part of that just that, you know, you were doing construction, you were building a thing, you could see the product of your work like growing right in front of you?
I build power plants, so yes and no.
Okay. Jim, thanks a lot for sharing that with us. I don't know. So Jim got into a flow there, but still 7 times 13 is a lot there, Jennifer.
Yeah. I mean, from one standpoint, it is a lot of work. But what we have found in our research, which I love that Jim talked about this, is that you can craft, it's called job crafting, which is essentially this ability to mind shift how you think about work and what you think is your purpose. And if there's meaning in your work, it is an actual, it is an actual, like I said, a protector for burnout. We found that purpose-driven roles, as long as it's not obsessive, it's in that harmonious stage, which is the healthy place that you want to be, like Jim's describing, it can really be an antidote for burnout. So he sort of figured out how to job craft his role so that it provides a more meaning. And I think when we can provide that, again, if we can offer that to employees to be able to do that on their own and give them the trust that they can figure that out, it will really help to prevent burnout inside of organizations.
Jim, thanks for that call. We'll go to Jackie in Appleton next. Jackie, hello.
Hi. So I just wanted to say that since COVID hit, my full-time job essentially went down to 0 hours, and then eventually I went back part-time, but it wasn't enough to pay the bills. And so I lost all of my benefits and my full-time work, and I'm now working 4 part-time jobs to make ends meet. Last summer, I applied to hundreds of jobs. Looking for a job became my job. And I was only interviewed by a handful of people, most of which offered me about 1/4 of what my income was. And so this is the route I had to go. I know I can't keep up at this rate. I've been able to maintain the sanity barely, but the yoga and the Epsom salt baths and all those wonderful things have held me over, but they're definitely not the solution here.
Jackie, thank you so much for sharing that story. Jennifer, I think of burnout as one person, one job, and maybe they're working too many hours, 60 hours a week. Jackie, not an uncommon scenario. She's having to piece together a whole bunch of different jobs, which brings its own levels of burnout, I would imagine.
Yeah, absolutely. And I really appreciate Jackie sharing that story, because in the research and across, lots of other data and research that we've seen this year, women have been disproportionately impacted, and we're seeing women actually being sort of pulled out of the labor force in dramatic ways that are going to impact the future of work for so many. And we're seeing this cobbling together of sort of women getting back into the workforce with these multiple jobs, working extended hours, dealing with all the other stressors of, juggling family life or whatever other things that they have to, the roles that they play, as caregivers and in their personal lives. And so we're really, watching this trend and making sure that it's not a big problem, but, or that we're going to solve it because it's a big problem. But what Jackie's saying is not atypical, and something that, that we all have to be really hyper vigilant around, understanding that this is a potential problem that's going to impact the workforce for decades.
Jackie, thanks for the call. And Jennifer, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Jennifer Moss is an expert on burnout and well-being at work. She's the author of the upcoming book, The Burnout Epidemic. You can find her piece at the Harvard Business Review, Beyond Burned Out. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Carl Christensen with a story about the first woman to win the Iditarod sled dog race.
Since 1973, the Iditarod Trail Sled Dog Race has brought together humans and dogs. They work together, traversing nearly 1,000 miles of brutal conditions across the frozen landscapes of the Alaskan tundra. Author Matt Geiger shares the story of Wisconsin native Libby Riddles, the first woman to win this world-renowned race.
So with dog racing, I think we all say you could have your highest and lowest moments in your entire life out there because it's so intense.
That's Libby Riddles talking with me on the phone from Alaska. In 1985, she was 30 miles from the Iditarod finish line in the belly of a heavy storm in the dark of night. Riddles and her dogs took a wrong turn. Unable to see more than a few feet in front of them, they ran on, unknowingly dashing away from the Bering Sea into the interior of the Alaskan wilderness, exhausted and running away from the finish line. Out of the night, Riddle saw a small cluster of houses. All were dark, but for one. She rode toward that single beacon of light. She stopped her sled, walked up to the home, and asked the man who appeared in the doorframe, that fragile symbolic portal between the domestic and atavistic spheres, a simple question. Where am I? He pointed her in the right direction and said goodbye. She was still in the lead. Riddle's headlamp was almost completely dead, and in the primal darkness, she headed back through the night, she, her team of huskies, and their sled surging forward as a single unit, flying toward the finish line. Riddle's was not the first woman to complete the last great race. She was the first to win it. This soft-spoken woman, who was shy in her youth and who did not set out into the world with any great ambitions beyond living and working with animals, had done something never done before. Far from the modern world, far from its paradoxical combination of comforts and concerns, she and her animals had traversed some of the harshest terrain on Earth, covering nearly 1,000 miles, besting every other competitor.
I mean, the moment when I won the Iditarod is going to be a pretty hard moment to beat ever in my whole life, really. One of my less famous quotes was, if I die now, it'll be okay, because that was just spontaneously what it felt like. It's like, wow.
I feel like it's, if I die now, it's okay.
Riddle started life in Madison, Wisconsin. From there, her family moved to La Crosse, where she has fond memories of the bluffs and the thunderstorms. She says the Midwest was a great training ground for what was to come later.
To me, it seems a pretty universal thing. Animals are very calming, especially dogs in a way, because, you know, they've actually co-evolved along with us for so many thousands and thousands of years. And yet they're kind of like a bridge between the wild animals and humans.
Today, Riddles lives in the Alaskan bush outside Homer. In the summer, she picks berries and makes jam, some of which she will trade with friends and neighbors for moose and salmon. She doesn't use a computer often, and her phone only works in one particular corner of her house. Even there, her voice flickers, coming and going, like visions of the trail on a winter night, as she and her dogs pushed on, happy and undaunted by the darkness around them.
I was, you know, a kid who's kind of shy of people sometimes, you know, except for maybe my close circle. And, you know, animals seem so much less complicated to deal with, I guess, in a way than people. I don't know. It's just, it kind of keeps people easier to deal with if you're around animals too, I guess.
Matt Geiger is a journalist and the author of Raised by Wolves and other books. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast feed, wherever you get your podcasts. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Carl Christensen.
Coming up after the news, a pediatrician and adolescent health expert tells us about the unique challenges facing parents and their teens during the pandemic and offers some advice along the way. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 8 on The Morning Show, springtime can be a big time for buying and selling houses. We'll find out what the housing and renting markets in Wisconsin look like these days and how the pandemic shook things up. That's tomorrow at 8 on The Morning Show. Now, teenagers everywhere are facing a few more obstacles than usual over the last year. For one, many are stuck at home with their parents all day, every day. Being a teenager and parenting a teenager can be difficult even in normal times. On top of that, a growing number of families have the added wrinkle of growing up in the midst of a number of different cultures at once, as immigrants or military families or families with different religious, cultural, or ethnic backgrounds. Because of these challenges, we're revisiting a conversation we had with Dr. Anisha Abraham. She's a pediatrician and adolescent health specialist. She also treats and counsels young people with a variety of issues, including social media use, drug use, and stress. She's the author of the book Raising Global Teens, a practical handbook for parenting in the 21st century. Here's our conversation from last November.
Well, a global teen is really a young person that's exposed to more than one culture in their daily life. And I wrote this book because I know that more and more young people are either moving from place to place, certainly from country to country or community to community. They may have parents that are immigrants. They are immigrants themselves. They may have parents, as you mentioned, from different backgrounds, or they may be exposed in their school or their daily environment to another culture. And it may not just be physical, but also virtually through social media or through the computer and through the internet. So a global teen is really, again, a young person that's had that exposure to more than one culture, which brings some wonderful things, but also can have some challenges.
Yeah, talk a little bit about some of the extra challenges that that can bring.
Well, what we do know is that if you have more than one culture, and I talk about my own experience growing up as the daughter of South Asian immigrants in Wilmington, Delaware, and the fact that it was a wonderful experience, but it wasn't until much later in life that I really could figure out who I could connect with most and who is my tribe and who I identified with. So certainly what young people do mention sometimes when they've had that cross-cultural experience is who is it that they feel most comfortable connecting with and really who is it that is their community. So that's one of the issues. Certainly if you're moving from place to place, and I've served as a military physician for a long period of time, and I can tell you that period of moving or transition or change can be really tough for young people. So one of the other issues that can occur is the issue related to grief and loss, leaving one community and having to rebuild yourself in yet another. And there certainly have been some thoughts also that when you are a cross-cultural teen, that this period of adolescence can be one that may be a little bit delayed because you're not having the normal kind of mirrors and anchors and the normal things that you would have in place if you only had one culture, if you were in a monocultural community. So there's a lot of things to be aware of when you do have a cross-cultural teen. But I certainly think there's also some wonderful strengths that we should be aware of too.
Yeah, talk about some of those positive sides of being a global teen through one of these many different roads you look at.
Yes, well, I also wrote this book because I'm the parent of two teenagers, and we had the wonderful opportunity to move from the United States and then live in Asia for several years, and then in Europe, and we've just recently returned back from living in Amsterdam, Netherlands. And I will say that some of the wonderful things that can happen when you have a young person that's had that experience of moving, much less, again, having parents from different backgrounds or having that exposure, can include things like adaptability and tolerance and a worldview. And these are certainly really important things to have right now, I believe. But on top of that, also things like having more than one language. And my own kids, for example, can speak several languages because they were exposed to these languages growing up. But also it's so much easier to pick up language when you're a young person than you are as an adult. So I think these are some of the important strengths that also come into place when you're a cross-cultural youth.
Talking to Dr. Anisha Abraham, pediatrician. Her new book is called Raising Global Teens, a practical handbook for parenting in the 21st century. And Dr. Abraham, I think a little secret of your book, so much of the advice as a parent of older teens myself is practical for, I think, any family. I want to start tapping into some of the advice you offer. I think one common theme that might generate conflict between teens and parents, global or otherwise, is, wait a minute, the standards that that my parents are applying to me are different than the ones of the kids in my school. And that might be because of different cultural backgrounds or whatever. What are some practical ways to navigate that kind of observation, that kind of problem?
And that can be a big issue. And there's so many different ways that can play out, whether that relates to alcohol use or it relates to sexual health. It relates to other norms that young people are trying to navigate as they're growing up. And I think it's very important for families to have conversations. And a lot of what I talk about in the book is the importance of creating and having conversations as a way to create connections with young people, but to also impart what your own values are as parents, and to certainly create those boundaries that and create those values that you think that are important for your teenager. Knowing that there are so many other values and so many other ways of perhaps also experiencing the world. So I think, again, coming back to conversations, talking about values, creating boundaries is an important way for parents to start to navigate this.
You share a lot of stories with Names Change, of course, of children you've worked with and their parents. One of my favorites is toward the end, a 16-year-old, I think, you worked with in Hong Kong, and you use her story to illustrate, you know, it's easy as parents and teens to focus on the problems. Here's the bad things that we need to fix. You use the story of a Queenie, I think is the name you used for her, to say, no, let's start with a positive thing. Can you share that with us?
Yes. I had a young patient in our clinic when I was working in Hong Kong at one of the public hospitals, and she came in to see me because she was struggling with issues related to her weight. but also had been teased quite often in school. She had recently moved to that location, was having a lot of challenges in terms of how she was feeling about herself. And so when she came in to see me initially, she really wasn't looking me in the eye. She had her hair kind of in her face. And one of the things that we always talk about, and I certainly start with as a pediatrician, is about strengths and what is it that someone does well in, but also what their dreams are for the future. I think it's a really wonderful way to start a conversation with a young person. And when I talked to her about what her dream was and also what she thought she did well in, she said, you know, I like to draw and I want to be a fashion designer. And so I said, you know, let's keep talking about that and thinking about that. And then we continue to talk about her weight and her blood pressure and all of these issues. And the fabulous thing that happened over the time that I saw her is that each time she came back, we talked, of course, more about how she was developing those strengths. She was drawing. She started to get into drawing classes. She bought a sewing machine. She started to make fabric dresses and different designs. And as she started to build on that strength and started to think about what she thought was her own personal dream, she also started to lose weight and she started to look me in the eye and started to feel more confident about herself. And the very last time that we met, I mentioned in the book that she actually drew a picture of a design for me, a dress that she had designed for me as a parting gift. But I use that story as just an example of how much we as adults and caretakers and certainly health providers can do in terms of working with young people to build on their strengths and certainly then to build on their self-esteem.
Let's bring on a caller. And Justina is with us in Egg Harbor. Justina, hello.
Hi there. Yeah, so we have a teen in the household who is struggling with it.
Oh, Justina, are you still there?
Still not in person. We've been remote since April, and mm-hmm. So school board is just now starting to rationalize and put a plan together to go back. And we're also noticing like constant phone use. So I'm wondering about just like tactical strategies.
And Justina, you cut out for a moment there. My producer said, I think the thing we lost was there's concern about anxiety or panic attacks.
Right. And then okay. I'm also wondering about phone use.
Gotcha. Justina, thanks a lot for the call. So worried about a teen with, and I'm sorry she cut out there, panic attacks during remote learning. And Justina, as we heard, concerned about phone use, social media use too, Dr. Abraham.
Yes. Well, Justina brings up some really important issues that young people are experiencing right now. And as she alluded to, the recent COVID pandemic is certainly making more young people feel isolated, feeling uncertain about the future, really not able to know how to perhaps get through things. And we are seeing more adults that are coming in with anxiety and depression, and certainly more young people as well. And the other issue that many parents report is that they're seeing more teenagers also using phones and other devices probably much more than they've ever done. And so really, what's the best way to navigate it? And my short answer is this is a really important time for us to really think about how we can support our teenagers related to mental health. It is a very difficult time for them. And so one of the things that I always go back to is, again, the importance of having conversations with young people about how they're feeling. And sometimes it's hard because they don't want to talk. They really are on their phone. They want to maybe be more with their peer group. But asking very specifically about how they're doing. And if they don't want to talk about themselves, my tip is to talk about what their friends are experiencing as a way to start to get them to talk about themselves. Are their friends feeling stressed or anxious? And then how are you doing? And I think Justina mentioned that her daughter was having some panic attacks. And so certainly knowing that, talking about those things specifically, asking what might be triggering it, I think are really important. Also perhaps thinking about the fact that she may actually need some additional support. And in many cases, this is where I say that there's a broader global village that's out there to help young people if they are having these issues. Certainly you as a parent can be the first, reaching out to a coach or a mentor, but also there's a lot of wonderful health professionals that are available that perhaps can help address some of these issues. And a lot of them are also doing this through telemedicine, so it doesn't mean you always have to go in. But certainly, again, if there are significant concerns about anxiety, I would consider having Justina's daughter talk to someone just for some additional support in terms of how to navigate that issue. The other piece that I would Sorry. I would just also mention in terms of the phone use, what a lot of young people do tell me is that phones are a good way for them to connect with their friends. And I think there's a lot of value to it. But I will just mention very quickly that if a young person's only on their phone and not doing anything else, that may also be a sign that they need to have a little bit more balance. And so getting them to work on a little bit of non-digital time, a little break from phones, being able to do a little bit of, if possible, outdoor time or exercise or mindfulness or whatever those self-care things are that can help are also really useful right now.
Nisha Abraham, pediatrician and the author of the book Raising Global Teens, a practical handbook for parenting in the 21st century. She joined us last November to talk about her book and the challenges facing teens and their parents during the pandemic. Coming up, we'll hear the rest of our conversation, including how parents can find novel ways to get their teens to open up about tough subjects. That's up next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we continue listening back to our November interview with Dr. Nisha Abraham. She's a pediatrician and adolescent health expert. She's the author of the recent book, Raising Global Teens, a Practical Handbook for Parenting in the 21st Century. Just a moment ago, we tackled how parents can help their teens deal with anxiety during the pandemic. Next, we'll hear ways that parents can get their teens to open up. Here's the rest of our conversation. Dr. Abraham, and a few minutes ago, you talked about one way to open up communication about things like anxiety. You also offer some just general practical advice for better question asking from parent to kid to generate conversation. What kind of advice do you have?
Yes, I think it's a big question that parents always ask me is how do we improve communication with our kids? Sometimes it's really difficult to get them to open up or to talk about difficult topics, much less, you know, to ask certain questions. And as I mentioned to Justina, I think it's really important to start by asking about peer group. As I mentioned, again, if you can talk about what friends are doing, sometimes it's easier for teens to talk about what they are experiencing themselves. My other tip is to sometimes avoid talking to them while you're looking them directly in the eye. And if you remember speaking to your own parents, sometimes it was really intimidating when they were looking you straight in the eye and talking about these challenging topics. So try to do it while you're doing an activity in parallel. For example, if you're walking with them or you're driving them, or as I sometimes do with my own boys, when it's late at night and it's dark in their room and they're perhaps already in bed, and then I come in and I start chatting with them and they're not really looking me in the eye anymore and they're just a little bit more relaxed. So my other tip, of course, is to think about doing it when you're not directly looking them in the eye. And my final quick tip is that sometimes we as parents, and I'm certainly guilty of this, is that we tend to go on, and we forget that our kids and teen brains are developing until sometime through the early 20s. And so they may not be able to completely connect all of the information that we are sometimes actually explaining. So less is more. And in fact, the recommendation that I have and certainly talk about in the book is sticking to what's called the 50% rule. So try to say half of all of what you are hoping to say, because sometimes making it very simple may be an easier way to have that connection and to have that effective conversation with your teenager.
Now, when we have a teenager, you know, sometimes we see, you know, mood swings and things like that, and can chalk it up to being a teenager and no big deal. How do we know, though, when where the line is between normal teenage stuff and a problem that we really need to look into and maybe even seek help for?
Right. And you know, that's tough. And certainly part of adolescence and part of being a teenager is actually sometimes feeling at one moment very happy, but the other moment very kind of sad. You know, there's certainly a lot of up and downs in terms of mood, partly because of brain development and all of the hormonal changes that are going on. But if you're noticing that your teenager is seeming to kind of go in and out of those moods a lot more than usual, they're even more irritable or prickly than usual. If there's changes in terms of they're sleeping a lot more or a lot less, or their eating habits are really changing. If you had a young person that was mainly connecting with their friends and now they're really not wanting to connect with their friends or do things like extra activities with their friends, that may be a concern. If anyone at all mentions dying or giving away their possessions or not wanting to be around anymore, that definitely is a red flag. So I think that it's really important as parents to be attuned. Sometimes you know your child more than anyone else, being attuned to these little changes that might be going on, but also very specifically asking. And what I talk about in the book is that Many times parents are afraid to ask how kids are doing. They're afraid to ask if they're depressed or suicidal. And in fact, what we do know is that if you do ask a teenager, you're more likely to get information and get them the support that they need. So again, asking very specifically if you are concerned is so important to, again, make sure that they get in for counseling or anything else.
Getting back to the global teen concept, you mentioned earlier the challenges, but also the rewards and benefits of, you know, the experiences of being around different cultures or different places and so on.
Yes.
How about for those parents who, you know, they are part of the dominant culture, the kid fits in culturally, but they want to bring some of those benefits in? Do you have thoughts on ways that people can give that kind of exposure to different cultures, even if it isn't just naturally part of their lives?
Absolutely. And I think that's so important to consider right now is how we can, again, open our own children and teenagers' minds to other cultures and experiences. And certainly one way to do that is traveling, which is, of course, a little bit more challenging right now. But post-COVID, I do think that, you know, having young people have that experience of being able to go to other places is really important. But you don't need to really go very far sometimes to be in a community that's very different from you. Sometimes even in your own state, even a couple of miles beyond, you know, you can have that experience of being in a very different community or culture. I also think that the idea of volunteering in other communities is also very beneficial for young people. Being able to attend events or activities or cultural organizations that are talking about other cultures. The idea of taking on another language is really important. It's certainly something that I would certainly encourage young people to consider is, of course, having more than one language and holding on to that language as another way to learn about other cultures. So these are just some of the ideas. Certainly there's other ways in terms of, you know, food and trying different foods, being open to other families of other backgrounds and trying to understand where they're coming from are other ways, again, to learn what's out there. But I certainly think this is so important right now that we are able to be open to these other experiences and what other cultures have to offer.
Dr. Abraham, just a minute left. Can you leave us a little bit of, I guess, parenting encouragement for getting through this COVID pandemic?
Well, it's, you know, it's a difficult time for everyone. And what I do know, having lived around the world, is that teenagers across the globe are going through the same experience of, again, feeling isolated, feeling anxious and feeling depressed. But I do think that we as parents have a tremendous ability to also build what I call resilience or having bounce, which is this ability to help kids to be able to handle and navigate challenge and disappointment. And in fact, that's one of the biggest predictors of success in life is ability to get back up on your feet after you've had a disappointment or challenge and be able to kind of navigate that failure. So I do think that the pandemic is a wonderful opportunity for us to also build that resilience, to certainly have conversations, to really support our kids in so many different ways.
That was Dr. Anisha Abraham. She's a pediatrician and an adolescent health specialist. She's the author of the book Raising Global Teens, a practical handbook for parenting in the 21st century. We talked to Dr. Abraham last November about her book and the challenges facing parents and teens during the pandemic. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, it's our weekly look at the top stories in national politics, including the race to the finish line for the new COVID-19 economic relief package. There's a new focus on keeping kids out of the criminal justice system by dealing with traumas that put them at risk. A Wisconsin pediatrician tells us about trauma-informed care. And a Wisconsin folklore expert shares legends from the state's lumberjack era. That and more tomorrow on Central Time. How about this nice weather? I'm seeing 40s up to 60 around the state, sunny everywhere I've checked out. I think a lot of us have a hankering for this, especially after that cold snap a couple weeks back. How are you enjoying the warm-up? Tweet us now at Central Time WPR. Central Time producer Tim Peterson is getting ready. Hey, Tim.
Hey, Rob.
So you made a warm weather purchase yesterday, I understand. What did you get?
I did. I bought a basketball.
All right. And you've already taken it for a spin, right?
Yeah, I did. We had a training this morning, and right after that training, I inflated it, took it across the street to the elementary school, and I missed a few layups.
And was this something you'd been plotting for a long time, or just as, like, the weather's so good, you got to do something, and basketball was the logical pick?
it was a logical pick. You know, we live across from this elementary school and have been, you know, seeing people out there. And it was like, you know, it's time. And found a basketball that I was able to pick up curbside a few miles away. And there you go.
And so I'm seeing Central Time, you know, we've got enough of us. We could form the least intimidating basketball lineup really in the country. What do you think?
I think we should go for it. I think we should put the word out.
All right. That is Tim, Court Thunder Peterson. I'm not very good at basketball nicknames. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.